么的。Okay, welcome or welcome back. You know the drill by now. Please do sign in. Please do sign in. If you haven't, you could do so right now. If you're not registered, please, after the class, go to the office and register. It doesn't cost anything. They'll do it for you. And if you aren't registered, do put your name on the sign-in sheet so that I know that you were here today, so that when you appear on the roster, I can give credit for the fact that you were in class. Okay? So please make sure you sign in each week. It's how we're getting funded. A few announcements. First, next week, Dave Rico is going to come to class and talk about the Five Longings, which I consider to be his most significant book and work. He says there are five basic motivations we have as human beings. I'll probably debate him on that a little. I think there are four, but we'll see. We actually have talked. No, we talked about it quite a bit. So, and then in 2 weeks, we're going to have a class on non-dual awareness. Finally, where's Ron and Amira, 2 weeks. Okay.
What does that mean?
I don't know much. That's why there's somebody else that's going to teach it, and you guys are all going to input. I'll announce it next week when I'm sure. Okay. The art fair is the last class, the 11th of May. Please do bring in your artwork to put around the sides of the room. There'll be time to look at it. Okay. So please bring anything you like, you know. It'd be great to have a lot of artwork here on the 11th. May 11th. May 11th. Yes, Michael.
Wanted to invite everyone to join us after class. Some people go over to the Daily Grind, a little coffee shop about a block and a half away, and you just reflect on what happened in class and just share experiences. So everyone invited. Maybe not everyone.
Okay, and Julie, you had an announcement.
Oh yeah, I got the it was in the Voice magazine. It's about Natalie Burke-Harris, MD, to discuss healing and long-term effects of child diversity. She said someone, I think it's on TED Talk too. Is this about TED Talk show?
So where is this going to be?
I don't know. That's how many it's going to read it.
Okay. So this is, what does this mean? Let's see. Healing the long-term effects of childhood adversity. And this is going to be UCSB Arts and Lectures. Nadine Burke-Harris, MD. So I don't know when it is.
Yeah, that's something you wouldn't ask because you know, it's kind of like psychology.
Anybody know when it's going to be?
Monday.
When is it?
Monday the 16th.
Oh, Monday the 16th.
I just read the book and it's about toxic stress, so children who grow up in adverse homes and how it actually can affect their DNA, physical things, asthma, ADHD, things that last until adulthood. So fascinating stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
And healing the effects thereof is pretty cool. So that's this Monday. Arts and Lectures. Yes.
I read a poetry book about my childhood in Iran. I'm half Armenian, half Russian. And it's called Blue Watermelon. I have it on the table. I'll be reading at Chaucer's on Monday at 7. And you are all invited if you could fit in.
This is Mary Freerich. All right, so let's talk a little, and then we'll. Oh, today is the class on artificial intelligence. I'll tell you why I did that afterward, but or after we meditate and I can calm down. But I want to talk a little before we sit. Buddhism has two complementary meditations that are its fundamental meditations. One is mindfulness. But it has sometimes been said that mindfulness is a little too cerebral for some people.
What does cerebral mean?
Cerebral means it comes from the mind. And so the other meditation, as many of you know, is metta, loving kindness, opening the heart meditation. And they seem to be a good balance. Some people do prefer one to the other. I like to do both. I like to do mindfulness first, and then toward the end of my sitting, I like to do some metta when I'm nice and focused. In Buddhism, they don't really make the distinction between head and heart. They call it the heart-mind, right? But we tend to, in the West, parcel these or separate these two. So whether or not you do formal metta meditation, it's often a good idea to pay attention while you're sitting to how you feel and opening your heart more and more completely. If you look at this diagram, what are you opening? Remember, I've said many times that our sitting is a practice in letting go, in opening up, in releasing, in allowing, in enlarging. Our sense of self becomes less compressed and more expansive and permeable. So one of the things we open is our body. That is the easiest level of mindfulness, and the level that most people, I think, are doing out there in the world, is just letting go of physical tension that they have. You know, so when you're mindful, you breathe and you relax and you breathe and you let go of physical tension. It's the sensation level. And then as you get better at being mindful, you open your mind as well as your body. That is, you allow your field of consciousness to release so that there's more space. You have a more spacious mind, so that thoughts can come and go without being blocked or held. They just kind of move through, and then eventually they quiet down. And there's just a feeling of peace and expansive awareness. But what about the heart? So we've opened the body and we've opened the mind. What about the heart? So when you open the heart, you not only open to whatever feelings are there so that they can move through you without impedance, you also open to a deeper level of feeling, a feeling of gratitude, of love, of appreciation that underlies these other more transient feelings. In formal metta practice, you actually call forth loving feelings. But I don't think it's necessary to do that. I think it's necessary just to allow the feelings to flow naturally so that as they kind of quiet down, there's this deeper upwelling of this basic gratitude for being alive or appreciation for being alive. But it turns out that metta meditation, this opening of the heart, has profound mental and physical benefits. It increases something called vagal tone. The vagus is the 10th cranial nerve. It goes from your brain stem down through your lungs, your heart, and your lower abdominal organ. So it's a very important nerve. It has to do with the parasympathetic nervous system, that is, with the relaxing and restoring part of your nervous system. You know, the autonomic nervous system has two parts. The sympathetic part revs you up, energizes you for opportunity or threat, for approach or for fight or flight. The sympathetic part of the autonomic nervous system gets you ready. The parasympathetic part relaxes you, restores your basic functioning, opens you to nurturance. So it's important to have both sympathetic arousal and parasympathetic calm. And vagal tone refers to the fact that some people supposedly are born and go through their lives with better vagal tone. That is, the vagus nerve is more likely in these people to allow release, relax, and calm. It's something it was thought was inborn, like something that didn't vary, something like your adult height. It's genetically determined, it doesn't vary. But it turns out not to be true, that people who practice metta meditation demonstrate better vagal tone, not only when they're practicing, but thereafter. So it varies, it changes something that was thought to be invariant. What that better vagal tone means is you're more apt to be able to relax, open, restore. One way to look at vagal tone is to look at heart rate variability. Many of you probably heard about that. It really seems to be really important. Heart rate variability has to do with the fact that when you breathe in, so oxygenated blood then is being sent to your muscles, your heart rate actually increases slightly. And when you breathe out, your heart rate falls slightly. And people with better vagal tone have higher heart rate variability. That is, when they breathe in, their heart goes up a little more, and their heart goes down, and when they breathe out, their heart goes down a little more. Some people, it doesn't change. It's invariant. They have poor vagal tone. They don't have heart rate variability or very much heart rate variability. But it turns out that this gradual up and down with the in-breath and the out-breath is very healthy in various ways, some of which that I know about are people with better heart rate variability, that is better vagal tone, are less likely to get diabetes, are less likely to have heart disease, are more emotionally intelligent, that is they can regulate their emotions better, and they have better relationships. So it turns out that heart rate variability is at least correlated with much better health outcomes. All of which is to say that when you're sitting, some of the time you bring your attention to your heart and you just allow your heart to open. So you're opening your body, you're opening your mind, and you're opening your heart. You're doing yourself a great service. That the opening of the heart seems to be important for mental and physical well-being. I don't know if all of that made sense. I thought about it about 20 minutes ago, if that's what I wanted to say, because I kind of learned it last night again. But I think it probably cohered slightly, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
I wouldn't want to take a test on it. But...
Well, I just took a test on it. I felt like medical school, which I didn't go to. They say in medical school, the following thing happens. You see a procedure, you do a procedure, you teach a procedure. That fast. I think I just graduated medical school. Because I heard about it last night. I didn't even think about it this morning. I'm going, oh my God, I really got to say that.
And I didn't hear about it.
I heard about it on a video that I actually showed in this class, Barbara Fredrickson talking about her work.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is close the door so that we don't get distracted. No one's sitting.
Hold out there.
Okay, so what I've just, Bernie.
Real quick question, types of meditation are, where does transcendental meditation fit in?
Okay, transcendental meditation, which many people here have done, is a concentration meditation. World's meditations break down into two categories. Most of the world's meditations are concentration meditations. You let go of everything else, you focus on your mantra. Keep coming back to your mantra, you get a much more expansive, elevated feeling. We start that way in mindfulness. You focus on your breathing, you let go of everything else, you get calm, you get clear, you get open. Then mindfulness takes another step. It says, now that you're focused on your breathing and you've kind of let go of everything else, open your awareness to notice everything else without losing your breathing. So you kind of re-engage with the world, but in this transcendental way. So TM is a great practice for mindfulness because you're most of the way there. You've got a steady, open awareness. Now just notice thoughts, feelings, and sensations without losing that steady, open awareness. So that's how mindfulness kind of...
Let's let her in.
You get it?
Good.
Okay.
She knows the ropes.
Okay. All right. All of what I've said may induce you to kind of try to do something when you sit. That would not be meditation. That would be doing something while you sit. The idea is when you sit, you forget about all this stuff that you just heard, and you just simply bring your attention to your breathing. Let yourself soften and open in heart, in head, in body. You just let everything open. And you just let everything be as it is. Your job is simply to relax, to open, and to notice. Don't try to make anything change. It will all change itself when you get out of the way. I guess I should write a book called Get Out of the Way. Actually, somebody has already written a book, which, the title of which I thought many years ago, which is Sit Down, Shut Up, and Pay Attention. All right, so here goes. Let's sit for 10 minutes. Right, so the reason that I went like this about AI is because there's so much out about it, and it's kind of so confusing, and there's so many extremely conflicting opinions about how important this will be and when it will be important. It's clear that it's important, but the question is how important and how transformative will AI be? So AI is artificial intelligence. The idea that we can program machines such that they can now program themselves. That is, that they can learn. And this is already part of our lives in ways that we generally don't know, but you're going to know in a minute. So first I want to read two announcements. These are from Technology Review, MIT's magazine of technology. The first is about a conference that just took place in March, end of March, in San Francisco. Sponsored by MIT, and the headline is Understand How Artificial Intelligence is Changing Every Business. So that was the conference then. The one that MIT is sponsoring in Cambridge, Massachusetts is in June, and the headline is AI and Robotics, that is putting computers inside robots, are changing the future of work at an unprecedented rate. Are you ready? So obviously something is major is happening here. The question is it just about work? And the answer is no, not at all. And so what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna alternate between showing you video of experts and then reading things to you that I have found to make an argument about what is happening and is likely to happen, okay? So the first thing we need to do is we need to make the room dark. And I need to. Yeah, if you pull that open, oh, that's great, thank you. And I gotta go with this, so maybe I can do one. like this.
I mean, that's so sweet.
That looked better. Here we go. Good.
Is it?
Yeah, so we need to make that one dark too. I need to put this on for a minute so I can see what I'm doing. I'll get the lights. There we go. I need a light so I can see what I'm about. If this.
You need a robot.
This is ridiculous. This is on. I know I need a robot. I need something. I'm not sure why this is behaving the way it is, but it needs to behave better. HDMI 1, let's try that. Big no, that's not it.
It seems like the computer's not on. Power to the.
Oh, that's a good point. Thank you. That's it. That was it. So it'll take a moment for this to grind itself up. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Michael. That always is. So while this is grinding its way up, there we go.
It says, did you mean?
Okay, now we got it.
Oh, one quick thing. That picture that you first saw, that beautiful picture of the ocean, that's something that comes up automatically with Windows 10.
Yeah.
Every time they send you a variety of pictures and they ask you to say if you like it or you don't like it.
Oh.
And I like to contribute to that, but I know they're using that information. I know that algorithms are running and they're going to present me with things from Microsoft. But I like that.
I like it too. Okay, so let's see. See if I can do the easy way on this one. Let's see. Didn't work. Okay. Gotta be a way to turn this thing off. Tap down off. Is this Friday the 13th?
It is. Yeah.
I think the above thing, too.
Can
you, oh, I see what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's got to work. It's supposed to work.
Yeah, there's, well, it came up, so it's got to come down. So I don't know why.
This is a YouTube right here watching this. It's right there.
It's good. It's working.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I can't get the lights off. Unbelievable. Tap down on.
That's it. We can see it. It's all right.
Yeah, well, not one of us. Okay, here we go. So this is a woman who owns an AI company talking about what AI is used for.
What's the AI mean?
Artificial intelligence.
Introducing Jiva, the world's first family robot. Say hi, Jiva.
Hi, Jiva.
Jiva helps everyone out throughout their day. He's the world's best cameraman. By intelligently tracking the action around him, he can independently take video and photos so that you can put down your camera and be a part of the scene.
Jiva, take a picture.
Excuse me, Dan?
Yes, Debo.
Melissa, just sent a reminder that she's picking you up in half an hour to go grocery shopping.
Thanks, Debo. In your homes helping you with your domestic chores, or intelligent thermostats keeping you warm and comfortable, or Google's autocomplete, which is more revealing about us humans than we are to each other. Fascinating, isn't it? You can find those videos on Nest and Jibo on YouTube and many such videos. And what about the future?
Too loud.
10 years from now, will we have robotic pets amongst us?
Closed caption.
Will we have human-like robots amongst us? Surgeonless surgeries? That's the Da Vinci. And driverless cars on scale? The possibilities are endless. And we are just at the beginning of this journey with artificial intelligence. It is an extremely exciting time for artificial intelligence. Our machines have gotten smarter than ever before, and more powerful. They have more memory, more storage, more connectivity, and more than anything else, they have access to us humans in ways they've never had before. They can sense. They can see with their cameras, hear with their microphones, feel with touch. We even have artificial noses and artificial limbs. And they're beginning to make sense of the world around them, recognize what they're seeing, understand what they're hearing. It's fascinating. But how many of us here really know that we are all responsible for making them a bit smarter every day? We tell them everything about us. We tell them who we are, where we go, who our friends are. We tell them everything about us. That's 200,000 photos every minute on Instagram. Every minute. 2.5 million pieces of content on Facebook every single minute. And they stopped being just machines now. They started becoming our friends. Our peers, our companions, that keep us company late into the night, long after everyone else has gone to bed. And whether we like to admit it or not, we're addicted to them. But interestingly, they are just as addicted to us. All those notifications on your phone, asking you to message someone, respond to an email, you know, look at that Facebook post somebody just did. That's them being addicted to us. They've shown us so much about the world. They've given us access. And in turn, we've opened up our world to them. Now, as a founder of an artificial intelligence and a computer vision startup called Mastery10, I am constantly occupied with the question of how to make AI a bit more meaningful to people. How can I use AI to bring a bit of joy, a little fun in someone's life? Now, technology for the longest time has been obsessed with the question of productivity and efficiency, all about making our lives faster, giving us instant access. Look where that's gotten us. We've sped up our lives while simultaneously emptying it. Well, at Mastery10, we're experimenting constantly to try and see how to bring a little bit of magic into someone's lives. Well, now let me take an example, something that most of you, this audience especially, is going to be able to relate to. How many of you out here have been out there with a friend at a wedding or a party and seen someone wearing something that you absolutely must have? So you took your phone out, took a picture of what they were wearing, stored it on your phone. You probably pinned it on Pinterest, WhatsApped it to a friend, and you hoped to go back home and find it online, but you were too disappointed that you couldn't. Let us take the example of how AI can solve that for you. Some other days, I'm about earthy green Indian clothes. Now, how many of us here can look across those two seemingly disparate colors, patterns, clothing, and explain to someone what is the connection between those two things or why we like them? AI can do that. It can look across tens of thousands of choices we've made, clothes we've bought, we've liked, shared with someone, and it pulls out the visual similarities across those different outfits and explain those connections, but it can also predict and help me see exactly the kinds of clothing that I like when I shop. Well, let's take another example this time, something closer to my heart this time. This one is on emotion recognition.
Smile. Good job.
See, if everything is fine, can you smile? Thank you. There you go. It is perfect. That should be normal. No good surprises. Good job, baby. That's it, Rina.
Very good. Good job. Next.
Scared.
Very good. Yeah.
Very excited to cry.
Yeah. What's next?
That is my 5-year-old daughter, Aditi. And when my husband, my co-founder, Anand, and I were taking this video of her and getting her to interact with this simple prototype that we've made using emotion recognition, it was a moment of sheer magic for her. She was three and a half at that point. That phone had stopped being a piece of rock, like a brick. It came alive. It became like a living being for her that recognized her emotion, interacted back with her. Can you imagine what kind of magic that is for a three-year-old? Well, as a mother of two, I watch my children grow every day. I have a 10-month-old and now a 5-year-old. And with my 5-year-old, it's lessons on social intelligence, emotional intelligence, on manners. And with my 10-month-old, it's all about crawling, walking, talking. And it is an intense journey, raising a human child. But often, I am reminded that we are in a very similar relationship with our machines. We just don't know it. We're like their parents, constantly feeding them more and more about the world, everything they live in. And they're like our children, absorbing the world, everything around them, and making sense of it. Now, in this journey, we as humans have a lot of questions to answer. Our popular media would love for us to believe that the killer robots are coming, and they're gonna, that we need to be scared. And dystopian futures make for fantastic storytelling. But we have a lot more to be worried about. What happens when we surround ourselves with AI that just reflect who we are? What happens when we surround ourselves with AI that build these echo chambers that amplify our biases, our stereotypes? They're just reflecting everything that they see. What happens to chance, to discovery, serendipity, magic? Will we become more and more machine-like in our journey to make our machines more human-like? Well, it's not all doom and doom with AI. The promise is exciting, but we must ask ourselves, what aspect of being human do we want to take forward with us in this journey as we evolve with our machines? We are here now. There is no going back. Thank you.
I do need to, I'm going to go back and forth, so I'm going to put the lights on, maybe. If they decide to go on. Okay, there we go. Okay. Okay. All right, a little bit more about the ubiquity of AI and the questions about its
desirability
or its not so positive possibilities. I think I can do that, this without this. Would you pull that one open? Just somebody pulled this front one open, so I can get a little more light, because this is not quite enough light for me. Yeah, I think you pull it open from the left side. So that'll give me enough, and that way we'll only have to close that one up. Perfect. Yeah, perfect. Okay. Yeah, pull it all the way open. Yeah, perfect. And that way I can read this, see it, and then we'll pull that one close again. Okay, so here goes. This is from Smithsonian last month. This month, actually. Okay. Today, nations and corporations are pouring billions of dollars into AI, whose recent advancements have startled even scientists working in the field. What was once a plot device in sci-fi flicks is in the process of being born. Hedge funds are using AI to beat the stock market. Google is utilizing it to diagnose heart disease more quickly and accurately. Actually, AI is moving into all kinds of medical fields. I just saw a video that showed it outperforming the world's best dermatologists at diagnosing melanoma. So it's really, because it's very smart and can has a lot of data that it learns on and can see patterns much better than humans, it's actually getting really useful in medicine, okay, quickly. Okay. And American Express is deploying AI bots to serve its customers online. Researchers no longer speak of just one AI, but of hundreds, each specializing in a complex task. And many of the applications are already lapping the humans that made them. So right now, just because I'm going to have to abbreviate everything in the time, right now we have localized AI or narrow AI, AIs that can do particular things particularly well. They can beat people, they can beat the world's best Go player at Go or the world's best chess player at chess. but they can only do those narrow things, and they learn within those narrow confines. The question is, when we get AGI, artificial general intelligence, that kind of machine intelligence which can not only do this thing well, but can learn to do anything well. In just the last few years, machine learning has come to seem like the new path forward. Algorithms, rules of how you do things, ways that you figure things out, algorithms freed from human programmers are training themselves on massive data sets and producing results that have shocked even the most optimistic in the field. So what computers can do now is they can figure out new ways to figure things out. They can learn, they can program themselves. And one of the scary things is we no longer know what they're doing. We didn't program them anymore. We programmed them to be able to program themselves, and they make their own rules now. So we don't know what the machine is doing to come to its conclusions. Also, we learn from data. Kids learn from try this, oh, that worked, that didn't work. So we're constantly bringing in data to adjust how we understand and manipulate the world. Machines can look at a lot more data, a lot quicker. First of all, there is a lot more data. And second of all, they can process it a lot quicker, so they can see patterns we can't see. Let's see. Earlier this year, two AIs, one created by the Chinese company Alibaba and the other by Microsoft, beat a team of two-legged competitors in a Stanford reading comprehension test. The algorithms read a series of Wikipedia entries on things like the rise of Genghis Khan and the Apollo space program, and then answered a series of questions about them more accurately than people did. So they understand, they can read better than we can. One Alibaba scientist declared the victory a milestone. These so-called narrow AIs are everywhere, embedded in your GPS systems and Amazon recommendations. But the ultimate goal is artificial general intelligence, AGI, a self-teaching system that can outperform humans across a wide range of disciplines. Some scientists believe it's 30 years away. We're going to look at actual predictions about how long it's going to take for this. Some scientists think it's 30 years away. Others talk about centuries. This AI takeoff, also known as the singularity, will likely see AI pull even with human intelligence and then blow past it in a matter of days or hours. Once it arrives, general AI will begin taking jobs away from people, millions of jobs, as drivers, radiologists, insurance adjusters. In one possible scenario, this will lead governments to pay unemployed citizens a universal basic income, a UBI, freeing them to pursue their dreams unburdened by the need to earn a living. This is already starting to happen. In another, it will create staggering wealth inequalities, chaos, and failed states across the globe. But the revolutions will go much further. AI robots will care for the elderly. It's already starting to happen. You know, AI companions are already part of elder care. Scientists, they're robots that actually talk to people and make them feel better.
I didn't know that was happening.
What? Yeah, it's happening now. Okay. Scientists at Brown University are working with Hasbro to develop a robo-cat that can remind its owners to take their meds and can track down their eyeglasses. Go find my eyeglasses, RoboCat. This is the next generation after the Roomba, which cleans your floor, you know. AI scientists, AIs will solve the problem of dark matter. AI-enabled spacecraft will reach the asteroid belt. While on Earth, the technology will tame climate change, perhaps by sending massive swarms of drones to reflect sunlight away from the surface. Okay. Last year, Microsoft committed $50 million to its AI for Earth campaign to fight climate change. But what about us? I do worry about a scenario where the future is AI and humans are left out of it. says David Chalmers, a professor of philosophy at New York University. If the world is taken over by unconscious robots, that would be about as disastrous and bleak a scenario as one could imagine. Chalmers isn't alone. Two of the heaviest hitters in the computer age, Bill Gates and Elon Musk, three, Stephen Hawking, have warned about AIs either destroying the planet in a frenzied pursuit of their own goals or doing away with humans by accident or not by accident. By the way, I just read an article 2 days ago by Rodney Brooks, the former director of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, and one of the guys who started iRobot, the company that does the Roomba, and also military robots, saying that we're doing the same thing we do with any great scientific revolution. We're overestimating the speed at which it will be adopted. So he's saying, now he's got a vested interest, you know, in not regulating the robots, but he's saying it'll take longer than some of these people think it's gonna take. And he's a very expert guy, but he's not the only expert guy. So let me read you a little bit about a couple of quotes from a couple of people whom you have heard of and whom I've just mentioned. Stephen Hawking: the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. It will take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans who are slowed by biological evolution can't compete and would be superseded. Claude Shannon, one of the founders of information theory, one of the very early computer scientists, said, "I visualize a time when we will be to robots what dogs are to humans." He further said, "And I'm rooting for the machines." Larry Page. Here's somebody on the other side. Larry Page, co-founder of Google. "Artificial intelligence would be the ultimate version of Google, the ultimate search engine that would understand everything on the web. It would understand exactly what you wanted, and it would give you the right thing. We're nowhere near doing that now. However, we can get incrementally closer to that, and that is basically what we work on." They're a lot closer than they were because of AI. Whenever I want to know anything, I just type the question in. I don't even need to know the good descriptors, and it gives me often the perfect answer right away. How does it know to do that? Elon Musk: the pace of progress in artificial intelligence, and I'm not referring to narrow AI, is incredibly fast. Unless you have this direct exposure to groups like DeepMind, you have no idea how fast. It is growing at a pace close to exponential. The risk of something seriously dangerous happening is in the 5-year time frame, 10 years at the most. Next person, Nick Bilton. He's a tech columnist who wrote in the New York Times. "The upheavals of artificial intelligence can escalate quickly and become scarier and even cataclysmic. Imagine how a medical robot, originally programmed to rid cancer, could conclude that the best way to obliterate cancer is to exterminate humans who are genetically prone to the disease." And James Barrett, author of "Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era," told the Washington Post, "I don't want to really scare you, but it is alarming how many people I talk to who are highly placed people in AI have retreats that are sort of bug out houses to which they could flee when it all hits the fan." And Elon Musk once again: "I'm increasingly inclined to think that there should be some kind of regulatory oversight, maybe at the national and international level, just to make sure that we don't do something foolish. I mean, with artificial intelligence, we're summoning the demon." And just on the other side, to be fair here, Ginni Rometty, who is the president, chairperson, and CEO of IBM, said, some people call this artificial intelligence, but the reality is this technology will enhance us. So instead of artificial intelligence, I think we'll augment our intelligence. Okay. Anything else? I definitely got to read you. Ray Kurzweil, who many of you know, a futurist, says, artificial intelligence will reach human levels by about 2029. Following that out further to say 2045, we will have multiplied our intelligence, the human biological machine intelligence of our following that further out to say 2045, we will have multiplied the intelligence, the human biological machine intelligence of our civilization a billion fold. And then Gray Scott, I don't know who he is, says, there's no reason and no way that a human mind can keep up with artificial intelligence by 2035. So anyway, some questions. Who's researching and developing AI? This is from Time Magazine, January 29th of this year. Just a little bit. China has now set its sights on the next tech frontier, artificial intelligence. On July 20th, China's State Council issued a next generation artificial intelligence development plan to become the quote, premier global AI innovation center by 2030. When it predicts China's core AI industry will be worth $148 billion, with AI-related fields at $1.48 trillion. China already rivals the world's leading developed nations by spending 2.1% of its $11 trillion GDP on research and development. It spends a lot of money on R&D. At November's Artificial Intelligence and Global Security Summit in Washington, D.C., Eric Schmidt, then executive chairman of Google parent Alphabet, predicted China's AI prowess will overtake the U.S. within this decade. Within a decade. Quote, by 2030, they will dominate the industries of AI. End quote, he said. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently said that whoever masters AI will become, quote, ruler of the world, end quote. So what will happen in the future? So I'm just going to read you a little bit of this, and then I'm going to show you two videos. One very short one, one longer one. The rise of, this is from Technology Review, March, April of this year, so it's current. The front cover is dueling AIs. As AIs compete with one another to solve a problem, they both get better. Anyway, this is by Kai-Fu Lee, who's the founder and CEO of Sinovation Ventures and president of the Sinovation Ventures Artificial Intelligence Institute. So he's an AI entrepreneur. The rise of China as an AI superpower isn't just a big deal for China. The competition between the US and China has sparked intense advances in AI that will be impossible to stop anywhere. The change will be massive and not all good. Inequality will widen. AI will displace a large number of jobs, which will cause social discontent. Consider the progress of Google DeepMind's AlphaGo software, which beat the best human players in the board game Go in early 2016. who was subsequently bested by AlphaGo Zero, introduced in 2017, which learned by playing games against itself, and within 40 days was superior to all the earlier versions. Now imagine these improvements transferring to areas like customer service, telemarketing, assembly lines, reception desks, truck driving, and other routine blue-collar and white-collar work. This is the most important part of the quote. It will soon be obvious that half of our job tasks can be better done at almost no cost by AI and robots. This will be the fastest transition humankind has ever experienced, and we're not ready for it. Okay. Then he goes on to say that not everybody agrees with him. Some people say that only some jobs will be taken and those people will be replaced internally in the same corporations. Other people remind us that every technology revolution has created new jobs as it displaces old ones. But it's dangerous to assume this will be the case again. Then there are the optimists who think that AI combined with humans will be better than each one alone. This will be true for certain professions, doctors and lawyers, for example, but most jobs won't fall in this category. Instead, they are routine, single-domain jobs where AI excels over humans by a large margin. Okay. So now I want to take it out a little, Bernie.
Okay, I sort of wrapped this whole thing up in my mind a long time ago. But one thing is knowledge, which is knowing the alphabet. And then there is intelligence, which is making sentences out of it. But then there's a thing called wisdom, which is Shakespeare. Where does the wisdom come from?
Let me let them talk about this. The point is that it's not clear what wisdom is. We don't really have a good definition of it. But it maybe has to do with a great deal of knowledge and understanding the principles that underlie that great deal of knowledge. That's a computer job. Okay, getting a lot of knowledge and seeing what the things that drive all that knowledge are, what the patterns are that evidence in the particular ways. So we could argue that AI is also already wise because it has the basic structure of wisdom. But let me not go there. I want to take this out a little further. So it's clear that AI is going to transform a lot of things. It's already transforming a lot of things. The question is, where is it going to go ultimately and how fast? I'm going to show you two videos, one very short, a very startling video, by one of the people who started at AI, period. So he's one of the best, most authoritative AI researchers. Then I'm going to show you another video which takes this out a little further. So, or not takes this out a little further, but goes a little deeper into this whole thing. So we need that closed again. And I need to get, the reason I'm rushing is because I want to get at least this much in. I have too much. So here we go.
Now we go to
I know you're not seeing anything yet. Yeah, there it is. Okay.
What's a super easy way to tell that your bed is awful? The raw egg test.
I'm getting rid of this. Okay. There we go.
Oh,
that's right. I gotta go like this.
Abracadabra.
Here we go. It's as good as I can do. All right. So we're going to here. We're gonna go to closed caption. Get you closed captions. And we're going to go to... So this is Jürgen Schmidhuber. Okay. 1150. 1150. So he's been talking about AI, how it's developed and what it's used for now, and now he's going to talk about where it's going to go. I think this is worth listening to. Here we go.
Then, like a scientist, one new interesting order after another. And it's going to scale. And I think in not so many years from now, for the first time, we are going to have animal-like AI. We don't have that yet. On the level of a little crow, which already can learn to use tools, for example, or a little monkey. And once we have that, it may take just a few decades to do the final step towards human-level intelligence, because technological evolution is about a million times faster than biological evolution. And biological evolution needed 3.5 billion years to evolve a monkey from scratch. But then just a few tens of millions of years afterwards to evolve human-level intelligence. We have a company which is called Nascence, like birth in English, Nascence, but spelled in a different way, which is trying to make this a reality and build the first true general-purpose AI. At the moment, almost all research in AI is very human-centric, and it's all about making human lives longer and healthier and easier, and making humans more addicted to their smartphones. But in the long run, AIs are going to, especially the smartphones, are going to set themselves their own goals, and I have no doubt in my mind that they are going to become much smarter than we are. And what are they going to do? Of course, they are going to realize what we have realized a long time ago, namely that most of the resources in the solar system, or in general, are not in our little biosphere. They are out there in space. And so, of course, they are going to emigrate. And, of course, they are going to use trillions of self-replicating robot factories to expand in form of a growing AI model, which, within a few 100,000 years, is going to cover the entire galaxy by senders and receivers, such that AIs can travel the way they are already traveling in my lab, by radio, from sender to receiver. Wireless. So, what we are witnessing now is much more than just another industrial revolution. This is something that transcends humankind, and even life itself. The last time something so important has happened was maybe 3.5 billion years ago, when life was invented. A new type of life is going to emerge from our little planet, and it's going to colonize and transform the entire universe. The universe is still young. It's only 13.8 billion years old. It's going to become much older than that, many times more, many times older than that. So there's plenty of time to reach all of it, or all of the visible part, totally within the limits of light speed and physics. A new type of life is going to make the universe intelligent. Now, of course, we are not going to remain the crown of creation. Of course not. But there is still beauty in seeing yourself as part of a grander process that leads the cosmos from low complexity towards higher complexity. It's a privilege to live at a time where we can witness the beginnings of that, and where we can contribute something to that. Thank you for your patience.
All right, so, leave everything closed. I'm just going to try to put one light on here. Okay, so you understand what he said, right? Which is we're cooking up a new kind of life, which is going to colonize the universe.
Is that really life?
That's a question, and the answer is we don't know that. Okay. Okay, that's a huge question. But whatever it is, it will self-replicate and it will improve. So if you look at life as the ability to self-organize and to grow, it's already happening. It's already life. Also, it's based on silicon, which is analogous to carbon. I think it's silicon-based life. I think it's just different than flesh and blood life. But anyway, and if you don't think so, try turning it off. Gone beyond that point. Okay, so now I'm going to give you, and I'm going to show you a video which kind of brings it all together. It's the most profound video of the 50 or so that I've had to watch. So this is a TED talk. You might want to see it again. I'll put closed captioning on it. This is Nick Bostrom, who is constantly referred to. He's a philosopher, but he's constantly referred to by AI people because he understands the implications so well. So this is his TED talk, and it kind of synthesizes things. So let's go here. We go here. What happens when our computers get smarter than we are? Here we go. Probably know how to run this machine better than me. That's not hard. Probably know how to turn off the lights, too. There we go. Closed captions, put it on. Nope, that's the wrong one. Settings. Need a speed bump. Nope.
It's already selected.
It's already there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Oh, no. I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's already on?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll believe you.
Play and
I'll believe you. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
That's it.
I work with a bunch of mathematicians, philosophers, and computer scientists, and we sit around and think about the future of machine intelligence, among other things. Some people think that some of these things are sort of science fiction, far out there, crazy. But I like to say, okay, let's look at the modern human condition. This is the normal way of things to be. But, if we think about it, we are actually recently arrived guests on this planet. The human species, well, like, think about if the world like was created, Earth was created 1 year ago. The human species that would be 10 minutes old. The industrial era started 2 seconds ago. Another way to look at this is to think of world GDP over the last 10,000 years. I've actually taken the trouble to plot this for you in a graph. It looks like this. It's a curious shape for a normal condition. I sure wouldn't want to sit on it.
Understand? It just goes right up with the
air. What is the cause of this current anomaly? Some people would say it's technology. Now, it's true. Technology has accumulated through human history. And right now, technology advances extremely rapidly. That is the proximate cause. That's why we are currently so very productive. But I like to think back further to the ultimate cause. Look at these two highly distinguished gentlemen. We have Kanzi. He's mastered 200 lexical tokens. An incredible feat. And Ed Whitman unleashed the second superstring revolution. If we look under the hood, this is what we find. Basically the same thing. Right? One is a little larger. It maybe also has a few tricks in the exact way it's wired. These invisible differences cannot be too complicated, however, because there have only been 250,000 generations since our last common ancestor, and we know that complicated mechanisms take a long time to evolve. So, a bunch of relatively minor changes take us from Kanzi to Whitman, from broken off tree branches to intercontinental ballistic missiles. So this then seems pretty obvious that everything we've achieved, pretty much, and everything we care about depends crucially on some relatively minor changes that made the human mind. And the corollary, of course, is that any further changes that could significantly change the substrate of thinking could have potentially enormous consequences. Some of my colleagues think we are on the verge of something that could cause a profound change in that substrate, and that is machine superintelligence. Like, artificial intelligence used to be about putting commands in a box. You would have human programmers that would painstakingly handcraft knowledge items. You build up these expert systems, and they were kind of useful for some purposes, but they were very brittle. You couldn't scale them. Basically, you got out only what you put in. And since then, a paradigm shift has taken place in the field of artificial intelligence. Today, the action is really around machine learning. So rather than handcrafting knowledge representations and features, we create algorithms that learn, often from raw perceptual data. Basically the same thing that the human infant does. The result is AI that is not limited to one domain. The same system can learn to translate between any pairs of languages, or learn to play any computer game at the Atari console. Now, of course, AI is still nowhere near having the same powerful cross-domain ability to learn and plan as a human being has. Cortex still has some algorithmic tricks that we don't yet know how to match in machines. But so the question is, how far are we from being able to match those tricks? A couple of years ago, we did a survey of some of the world's leading AI experts to see what they think. And one of the questions we asked was, by which year do you think there is a 50% probability that we will have achieved human-level machine intelligence? We define human-level here as the ability to perform almost any job, at least as well as an adult human, so real human-level, not just within some limited domain. And the median answer was 2040 or 2050, depending on precisely which group of experts we asked. Now, it could happen much, much later, or sooner. Like, truth is, nobody really knows. What we do know is that the ultimate thing we asked was, by which year do you think there is a 50% probability that we will have achieved human-level machine intelligence? We define human-level here as the ability to perform almost any job, at least as well as an adult human, so real human level, not just within some limited domain. And the median answer was 2040 or 2050, depending on precisely which group of experts we asked. Now, it could happen much, much later, or soon.
There we go. So, 10% human level machine intelligence, 10% probability that we'll get the top 100 are the best 100 people. All the people they asked as a combined, the top people said by 2024, we have a 10% chance of getting general AI. 50% chance by 2050, 90% chance by 2070. Combined, it's a little bit more, it's roughly the same, 2022, 2040, 2075. So everybody thinks that it's likely sometime in the latter part of this century that there'll be machines will be more intelligent than human beings in the broader sense of intelligence. Mary,
we seem to leave the heart and ethic totally out of machines.
We're going to go there.
Okay.
We're going to go there. Okay.
Sooner, like, truth is, nobody really knows. What we do know is that the ultimate limits to information processing in machine substrate lie far outside the limits in biological tissue. This comes down to physics. A biological neuron fires maybe at 200 hertz, 200 times a second. But even a present-day transistor operates at a gigahertz. Neurons propagate slowly in axons, 100 meters per second tops. But in computers, signals can travel at the speed of light. They're also size limitation, like a human brain has to fit inside a cranium, but a computer can be the size of a warehouse or larger. So the potential for superintelligence kind of lies dormant in matter, much like the power of the atom lies dormant throughout human history, patiently waiting there until 1945. In this century, scientists may learn to awaken the power of artificial intelligence. And I think we might then see an intelligence explosion. Now, most people, when they think about what is smart and what is dumb, I think have in mind a picture roughly like this. So at one end we have sort of the village idiot, and then far over at the other side we have Ed Witten, or Albert Einstein, whoever your favorite guru is.
Yeah.
But I think that from the point of view of artificial intelligence, the true picture is actually probably more like this. AI starts out at this point there, at zero intelligence, and then after many, many years of really hard work, maybe eventually we get to mouse level artificial intelligence, something that can navigate cluttered environments as well as a mouse can. And then after many, many more years of really hard work, lots of investment, maybe eventually we get to chimpanzee level artificial intelligence. And then after even more years of really, really hard work, we get to village idiot artificial intelligence. And a few moments later, we are beyond Ed Witten. The train doesn't stop at human build station. It's likely rather to swoosh right by. Now this has profound implications, particularly when it comes to questions of power. For example, chimpanzees are strong. Like pound for pound, a chimpanzee is about twice as strong as a fit human male. And yet, the fate of Kanzi and his pals now depends a lot more on what we humans do than on what the chimpanzees do themselves. Once there is superintelligence, the fate of humanity may depend on what the superintelligence does. Think about it. Machine intelligence is the last invention that humanity will ever need to make. The machines will then be better at inventing than we are, and they'll be doing so on digital timescales. What this means is basically a telescoping of the future. So think of all the crazy technologies that you could have imagined maybe humans could have developed in the fullness of time. So cures for aging, space colonization, self-replicating nanobots, or uploading of minds into computers. All kinds of science fiction stuff that's nevertheless consistent with the laws of physics. All of this a superintelligence could develop, and possibly quite rapidly. Now, a superintelligence with such technological maturity would be extremely powerful. And at least in some scenarios, it would be able to get what it wants. We would then have a future that would be shaped by the preferences of this AI. Now, a good question is, what are those preferences? Here it gets trickier. To make any headway with this, we must first of all avoid anthropomorphizing. And this is ironic because every newspaper article about the future of AI has a picture of this. And so I think what we need to do is to conceive of the issue more abstractly, not in terms of vivid Hollywood scenarios. We need to think of intelligence as an optimization process, a process that steers the future into a particular set of configurations. A superintelligence is a really strong optimization process. It's extremely good at using available means to achieve a state in which its goal is realized. This means that there is no necessary connection between being highly intelligent in this sense and having an objective that we humans would find worthwhile or meaningful. Suppose we give an AI the goal to make humans smile. When the AI is weak, it performs useful or amusing actions that cause its user to smile. When the AI becomes super intelligent, it realizes that there is a more effective way to achieve this goal. Take control of the world and like stick electrodes into the facial muscles of humans to cause constant beaming grins. Take another example. Suppose we give AI the goal to solve a difficult mathematical problem. When the AI becomes super intelligent, it realizes that the most effective way to get the solution to this problem is by transforming the planet into a giant computer so as to increase its thinking capacity. And notice that this gives the AI an instrumental reason to do things to us that we might not approve of. Human beings in this model are threats. We could prevent the mathematical problem from being solved. Now, of course, presumably things won't go wrong in these particular ways, right? These are cartoon examples. But the general point here is important. If you create a really powerful optimization process to maximize for objective X, you better make sure that your definition of X incorporates everything you care about. This is a lesson that's also taught in many a myth. King Midas wishes that everything he touches be turned into gold. He touches his daughter, she turns into gold. He touches his food, it turns into gold. This could become practically relevant, not just as a metaphor for greed, but as an illustration of what happens if you create a powerful optimization process and give it a misconceived or poorly specified goal. Now you might say, well, like, if a computer starts sticking electrodes into people's faces, like, we just shut it off. A, this is not necessarily so easy to do if we've grown dependent on the system. Like, where is the off switch to the internet? B, why haven't the chimpanzees flipped the off switch to humanity? Or the Neanderthals? Like, they certainly have reason. We have an off switch, for example, right here. The reason is that we are an intelligent adversary. We can anticipate threats and plan around them, but so could a super intelligent thing. And it would be much better at that than we are. Point is, we should not be confident that we have this under control here. We could try to make our job a little bit easier by, say, putting the AI in a box, like a secure software environment, virtual reality simulation from which it cannot escape. But how confident it would be that the AI couldn't find a bug? Like, given that merely human hackers find bugs all the time, I'd say probably not very confident. All right, so we like disconnect the Ethernet cable to create an air gap. But again, like merely human hackers routinely transgress air gaps using social engineering. Like right now, as I speak, I'm sure there's some employee out there somewhere who's being talked into handing out their account details by somebody claiming to be from the IT department. More creative scenarios are also possible. Like if you're the AI, you could imagine like wiggling electrodes around in your internal circuitry to create radio waves that you can use to communicate. Or maybe you could pretend to malfunction, and then when the programmers open you up to see what went wrong with you, they look at the source code, bam, the manipulation can take place. Or it could maybe output the blueprint to really nifty technology, and when we implement it, it has some surreptitious side effects that the AI had planned. The point here is that we should not be confident in our ability to keep a super intelligent genie locked up in its bottle forever. Sooner or later, it will out. I believe that the answer here is to figure out how to create super intelligent AI such that even if, when it escapes, it is still safe because it is fundamentally on our side, because it shares our values. I see no way around this difficult problem. Now, I'm actually fairly optimistic that this problem can be solved. Like, we wouldn't have to try to write down a long list of everything we care about, or worse yet, spell it out in some computer language like C++ or Python. Like, that would be a task beyond hopeless. Instead, we would create an AI that uses its intelligence to learn what we value. And this motivation system is constructed in such a way that it is motivated to pursue our values or to perform actions that it predicts that we would have approved of. We would thus leverage its intelligence as much as possible to solve the problem of value loading. This can happen, and the outcome could be very good for humanity. But it doesn't happen automatically. The initial conditions for the intelligent explosion might need to be set up in just the right way if we are to have a controlled detonation. The values that the AI has need to match ours, not just in the familiar context, like where we can easily check how the AI behaves, but also in all novel contexts that the AI might encounter in the indefinite future. And there are also some other esoteric issues that need to be sorted out, the exact details of its decision theory, how to deal with logical uncertainty, and so forth. So the technical problems that need to be solved to make this work look quite difficult. Not as difficult as making a super intelligent AI, but fairly difficult. Here's the worry. Making super intelligent AI is a really hard challenge. Making super intelligent AI that is safe involves some additional challenge on top of that. The risk is that somebody figures out how to crack the first challenge without also having cracked the additional challenge of ensuring perfect safety. So I think that we should work out the solution to the control problem in advance so that we have it available by the time it is needed. Now, it might be that we cannot solve the entire control problem in advance because maybe some elements can only be put in place once we know the details of the architecture where it will be implemented. But the more of the control problem that we solve in advance, the better the odds that the transition to the machine intelligence era will go well. This to me looks like a thing that is well worth doing. And I mean, I could imagine that if things turn out okay, that people a million years from now look back at this century, and it might well be that they say that the one thing we did that really mattered was to get this thing right. Thank you.
Let's turn this on again. We have the, we don't need the light so much, but could let's just pull one of those open and just talk for a little bit. So obviously what everybody is saying is this is really important. The question is when this, when general AI is gonna happen. But the problem is that unless, as Nick Bostrom says, we structure things in such a way that super intelligent AI or general AI acts in accord with human well-being, then there's no way to know whether that will happen, and there's no reason to predict that it will happen. What he talked about is an optimization process. If we give AI the goal of assuring world peace, seemingly a very noble goal, and we said AI just does what it does, you know, it works in ways we don't know, then maybe it comes up with the conclusion that the way to ensure world peace is to kill everybody in all the countries that might contest with us so that our country then dominates the world and then there's world peace. You know, much more prosaically, what Elon Musk worried about is if we make autonomous weapons, which we already are making, by the way, they go out and they're programmed to shoot. Well, they don't kind of know how to distinguish between you and I, and it's kind of hard to turn them off because then they become less useful. So we've already got a situation where some of these things are working to optimize various goals we've given them, but not necessarily in a way that we would approve of. So there's a huge concern in the AI community, like there is in the genetics community and the genetic engineering community, to get some kind of ethical guidelines in place and some kind of procedural guidelines in place such that as this develops, it develops in a healthy way. Because otherwise, wait, to use a metaphor again about genetic engineering, you know that people are if they're not already doing it, they're going to say, well, now that you told me what the genome of my potential child is, I want you to fool around with that genome to make a smarter, stronger, healthier, happier child. That's now. So what about some company saying, well, I want our company to dominate the economic picture in the future. Why don't we create an optimization process so that our company wins? What will that mean about other companies? Okay, so questions. Okay, so first Robert, and then we'll go Michael, and then we'll go Leslie, okay?
So I'm just back from the science of consciousness, the convention, and some of the big AI people were there, including the guy who invented deep learning. And he's concerned that, you know, he invented the deep learning idea 30 years ago, and he says it's run its course and we're way overdue for planting the seeds for something better. Deep learning is very limited in understanding. It just sort of does its thing. But on the other hand, Europe is making laws now that AI used for like mortgage approval, things like that, has to be transparent. So that actually could change the picture. Those laws are going into place now.
Yeah, so people are concerned about this.
Yeah.
Deep learning is one AI strategy that has to do with making computers that are kind of like the mind. But there are other strategies. Okay, so we're going to do two more, and then with this, then I'll say a final comment, we'll dismiss. Michael and then Leslie. Okay.
There's an amazing series on Netflix now called Black Mirror.
Yes.
And each episode is different, like a separate film, and it deals with AI, social media, technology, and it's one of the most amazing things I've seen. It's well worth watching. It's now 2 years into it.
Black Mirror, right?
Black Mirror.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Okay, Leslie.
I'm concerned regarding the ethics that it's already too late given what's happened with Facebook. And I'm thinking, like, if I get off Facebook, they already have all my information. And what some of the speakers said, that even if you unplug, you know, what happens then? It's just very frightening to me.
Well, you can't unplug. Actually, Facebook has shadow profiles on people that aren't even on Facebook. The point is that if you get on your device at all, there's going to be information that's going to be recorded about you because it's useful in some economic way. And there's no way to not get on some sort of connectedness if you're going to live in the world.
The fact that they could create a winner of the presidential election by what they did, I mean, that's frightening.
Yeah. Okay, so Bernie, and then Mary.
It was addressed, but it goes deeper into the human mind here. How do we prevent an Adolf Hitler from having an artificial intelligence organization that is good? Because he is doing the right thing. He wants to tell all these people these people were the right ones.
You don't even need to presume somebody's going to be sinister. Obviously, a sinister person getting a handle on this rules the world,
right,
like Vladimir Putin said. But you don't even need a sinister figure. You just need somebody that wants to get ahead. And the genie, what is created, gets out of the bottle. And that has already happened. The thing that the United States did to nullify the Iranian nuclear program, remember the Stuxnet worm? That was a genie that got out of the bottle and screwed up, and that's a very minor situation. So the question is, what do we do about this? We have now an ability we didn't have. It's not going to go away. The question is, how can we regulate it? Just like nuclear energy. You know, that's an ability that we have. The question is, can we keep people from blowing each other up with it?
But we've never stopped from the beginning of mankind killing each other. Why are we going to change our thinking about that?
Because we're going to use all this stuff that we've been talking about to change people's minds so that people don't think in terms of killing one another. That's my solution to saving the world, is change. It doesn't matter what AI, what Facebook knows about me, or what the Russians know about my preferences. If I use my intelligence and I'm not swayed by that, then I make an independent decision no matter what the media are feeding me. So the solution to manipulating elections is to cause people to understand what the actual situation is so they can make a good decision irrespective of the propaganda that they're being fed. I mean, we're the ultimate fail-safe for this. Okay. There was one more hand. Mary.
I'm not even sure how to word this question. I just heard recently they made a jaw for a woman, and she can't eat or drink. She's gonna be able to. And I also heard that ISIS is gonna use this intelligence, whatever, to bomb with robots wherever they want. And I can't quite conceive who can totally be in control of artificial intelligence. Maybe nobody can. I mean, what if China decides to make it evil and we're trying to give it values? Who is in control? It leaves my head. I don't understand.
What the best minds around are saying is we have to kind of, this is something that all of life is involved with, all of humanity and more generally all of life. So we have to use our intelligence right now to kind of try to understand how to cooperate here, like climate change, for example, which every country in the world except the United States is cooperating on, but California is anyway. So the point is that we have to use our intelligence to anticipate what the consequences of these new abilities that we have are, and we have to do it because it's something that affects everybody. There's some possibility that all parties will be party to this agreement. The way to get, in psychology, there's classic research about how you get individuals or groups that are warring to cooperate. What you do is you give them a superordinate threat
that threatens both of them, and then they have to cooperate and they have to put down their arms because there's something bigger that they have to deal with. That's climate change, okay? In that people around the world are gonna have to cooperate or we're all gonna suffer. Well, this is another possible scenario like that. If we make this genie and we don't do it in an intelligent way, everybody's gonna go down. So the point about these powers that we have is they induce us to have to come together as a humanity to deal with these capabilities. All right, we gotta get out of here, way out of here. I'll see you next week. We'll talk about the five longings.